This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, the 19th of July, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission wants to fast-track changes to improve safety at US reactors. Legal scholars accuse the US of neglecting women and sexual minorities in its counter-terrorism policies. And in the Pacific Northwest, scientists are looking at the impact of fossil fuels on the marine ecosystem. We'll take you along one of their research trips. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. House of Representatives considered the so-called cut, cap, and balance measure today. The bill would mandate more than $100 billion in spending cuts in 2012, but does not define those cuts. It would also limit future federal budgets, irrespective of future needs. And it would force both chambers to amend the U.S. Constitution, requiring federal spending to stay within the limits of federal income without removing income tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. Georgia Representative Hank Johnson spoke against the measure.
We need jobs and economic growth, not cut, cap, and balance, which is, again, just slash and burn politics, Ryan budget proposal with lipstick, and that's the real deal. That's realer than real deal Holyfield.
The bill was put forth by Tea Party Republicans as a prerequisite for their agreement to raise the federal debt level. But the measure has little hope of success in the Senate, and President Obama has clearly said that if it does make its way to his desk, he will veto. In Wisconsin, more recall elections are taking place today. All told, nearly a third of the state's senators face recall due to voter outrage over their role in Governor Walker's anti-union legislation. Molly Stentz reports from WORT in Madison.
Today marks round two of 4 days' worth of recall elections this summer. Democratic State Senator Dave Hansen of Green Bay faces Republican David Vanderleest, a Tea Party-backed candidate whose record of domestic violence has become a central campaign issue. The two other races today are Republican primaries. The winners will face incumbent Democratic senators in a general election on August 16th. Three Democratic state senators and six Republicans are being forced to run for their seats again mid-year, an event that has never happened before in this state. Some Republican voters are angry with their senators for leaving the state earlier this year and say they were abandoned by their elected officials. 14 Democratic senators left Wisconsin for several weeks in a strategic move to slow the vote and force debate on the fast-moving bill to strip public workers of their unions. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
A federal judge refused to grant an injunction to a Vermont energy company that would have allowed an aging nuclear plant to keep operating beyond the duration of its state license. Carl Ettnayer reports from Peru, Vermont.
This spring, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission extended Vermont Yankee's federal license for 20 years. But its state license expires in March, when the plant turns 40, and the legislature has blocked any extension. The plant's owner, Entergy Nuclear, sued Vermont in federal court, arguing that federal laws preempt state regulation. At the same time, Entergy asked the court for a preliminary injunction. Chief Nuclear Officer John Herron testified that the plant might be too financially risky to operate beyond this fall if the judge denies the injunction. Judge Garvin Murtha wrote that he was unconvinced Entergy would shutter the plant early if he denied the preliminary injunction. Entergy will get the certainty it desires only from a speedy trial and a timely decision, he wrote. The trial is scheduled for September. Entergy issued a statement saying they are assessing the company's near-term options. Carl Ettnayer, FSRN, Peru, Vermont.
The Israeli Navy intercepted the last boat in the Gaza-bound Freedom Flotilla earlier today. Jillian Kessler-Diamore has more.
The French boat Dignité El Kazama was boarded by Israeli Navy commandos in international waters off the coast of Gaza earlier today. The Israeli Navy began trailing the Kazama while it was 50 miles from Gaza and boarded the ship before it could reach its destination. There were no immediate reports of any violence. According to video footage provided by the Israeli military, Israeli Navy officers communicated with the 16 international activists on board before taking control of the vessel.
Dinite El Karameh, what is your final destination?
Our final destination is Gaza port.
The Dignité El-Karamah was one of 10 boats attempting to break the Israeli siege on Gaza as part of the International Freedom Flotilla. It was the only vessel in the aid convoy that succeeded in leaving a European port en route to Gaza. The activists were rerouted to the Israeli coastal city of Ashdod, where they are expected to be interrogated by Israeli immigration authorities and then deported. Adam Keller, a spokesperson for a coalition of Israeli peace groups, condemned the takeover. Jillian Casodemor, FSRN, Jerusalem.
Yesterday, Israel banned Knesset member Hanin Zoabi from participating in any parliamentary activities for the next 2 weeks for her participation in last year's flotilla. Last May, Israeli Navy commandos killed 9 activists on board the Mavi Marmara as it attempted to sail to Gaza. For Free Speech Radio News from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. The nuclear disaster at Fukushima forced countries around the world to reevaluate their use of nuclear energy. Here in the US, safety concerns are mounting about the more than 100 nuclear reactors currently operating. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission debated recommendations from their task force on Tuesday that would overhaul current protocol. Alice Olstein reports.
The NRC commissioners grilled members of the task force about the sweeping changes recommended in the report, including requirements to evaluate earthquake and flood hazards every 10 years and address any risks uncovered, implement more extensive disaster training, and make plans to deal with long blackouts. Commission Chair Gregory Yatsko wants the new rules presented to the nuclear industry within 90 days. During that time, the commission would hear feedback from experts and industry heads in a series of public meetings. Once passed, the industry would have 5 years to implement the changes. But getting all of the NRC commissioners on board with the rule changes will be a struggle. Commissioner Christine Zvinicki, a former Republican staffer, pointed to the report's assurance that U.S. nuclear plants are generally safe from a Japan-style disaster.
Even though that's unlikely, in the U.S. we have mitigation measures that would further reduce the effect of something like that, even if it occurred with its low likelihood.
She went on to question the need for enhanced safety measures. But Commissioner Georgia Pastalakis refuted the idea that the Fukushima disaster was a freak accident that could never happen in the U.S.
We've heard a lot that what happened in Japan was beyond design basis. Some people are saying that what happened was the unthinkable and that we have to think about the unthinkable as we regulate nuclear power. There is growing evidence that it was not unthinkable at all, that it was indeed a beyond design basis event in Japan, but the design basis was not good enough.
The design and location of several U.S. nuclear power plants have recently come under scrutiny. In June, flooding in the Midwest threatened 2 facilities near Omaha, Nebraska. One of the plants was already offline for refueling, but the other continues to operate at full capacity, even with floodwaters nearing the height of its protective barrier. Other vulnerable nuclear plants include New York's Indian Point, which sits on an active fault line, and Florida's Turkey Point facility, because hurricanes regularly strike the area.
As climate chaos worsens, as extreme weather becomes not only more frequent, but more intense, nuclear power plants are just going to be too risky from a safety perspective to even operate.
That's Kevin Camps, a radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. He says the NRC's new rules are not only long overdue, but insufficient. He took issue especially with the emergency plan to release radioactive steam from a plant's reactor in order to avoid a meltdown.
Yes, it would prevent a more catastrophic release, but it would require the release of large-scale amounts of harmful radioactivity.
Some U.S. lawmakers, like Connecticut Independent Joe Lieberman, have called for a temporary moratorium on nuclear power while the Japan disaster is still under investigation. While a moratorium is not likely, the NRC task force can choose to designate their recommendations as orders and force the nuclear industry to comply. When the report was published, Republican leaders from the House Energy and Commerce Committee wrote to the NRC demanding a longer review period. In response, a group of 15 organizations, including the Union of Concerned Scientists and Greenpeace, sent a letter to the NRC urging them to stick to their timeline. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The National Labor Relations Board continued a second day of public hearings on proposed amendments to union representation elections. The current process starts with a petition from employees to the NLRB and ends with a secret ballot in which workers decide whether they want union representation. Critics of the process say it takes too long and is manipulated by employers. The amendments include allowing important documents like the petition for an election to be circulated electronically and setting fixed timeframes, such as holding any pre-election hearing 7 days after a hearing notice is served. During the 2 days, more than 60 speakers from business, labour, academic and advocacy communities made presentations. The AFL-CIO's Elizabeth Bunn said the proposed amendments improve the efficiency and fairness of the election process.
Being able to influence timing and delay, the employer is able to implement its own campaign timetable. All too often, employers illegally discipline workers, hire unscrupulous consultants, force employees to attend group and one-on-one meetings, and sometimes even threaten to close the plant. The goal is not to inform. The goal is to harass, delay, confuse, and intimidate.
By way of example, Bunn cited the case of healthcare workers at HCR Manicare in Pennsylvania, who since 2007 have tried to organize an election among employees to decide whether to join a union. Employers have taken advantage of the delays possible under the current laws, and no vote has yet taken place. The NLRB says the changes will fix flaws that cause unnecessary delays and lead to wasteful litigation. But many business interests are opposed. Harold Weinrich is from the legal firm Jackson Lewis that represents employers in labour relations issues. He said the change would not give employers enough time to express their views.
The secret ballot election process can only work better if there is an informed electorate. And these rules take the time period, which has been the same for decades, approximately give or take 40 days, and cuts that down to 10 or 14. And that abridges the rights of employees and the rights of employers.
During the hearing, Assistant Professor Dorian Warren from Columbia University presented the results of his study that analyzed a random sample of 1,000 NLRB elections, looking at the time it took for elections to take place and when employers were able to voice their opposition. It found that 47% of employers expressed serious opposition to possible moves by their workers to unionize before the workers had even filed a petition asking for the right to vote on unionization.
Contrary to previous witnesses who claim that employers have little or no ability to communicate effectively with employees, the voicing of employer opposition to union representation begins from the moment employees begin talking about the union and continues day after day, week after week, leading up to the election. Our study reveals the pervasiveness, consistency, and intensity of employer opposition to workers exercising their rights to union representation.
Written submissions on the NLRB's proposed changes to union representation elections can be submitted until August 22nd. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Legal experts at New York University have released the first study examining how U.S. counterterrorism policies have affected the rights of women and sexual minorities. The 3-year investigation, which included scores of interviews with U.S. and foreign government officials and non-government agencies across the world, has found that these policies have failed to protect women and sexual minorities from terrorism. For more on the report, called A Decade Lost, Locating Gender in U.S. Counterterrorism, we're joined by co-author Lama Faki from the Center for Human Rights and Global Justice. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you for having me, Danny.
What led you to conduct this study? Was there a particular incident or chain of events in which you realized the impact of counterterrorism policies on women and sexual minorities was being neglected?
My colleague Jane Huckabee and I were working on behalf of two individual Yemeni clients who were victims of the U.S. government's secret detention program. And through our work with them, we were exposed both obviously to the direct impacts that they face from U.S. counterterrorism, but also witness the impact that these measures had on their families. And through the course of doing that work and through additional kind of research and investigation, we began coming across numerous trends in which women and LGBTI individuals were experiencing adverse impacts from U.S. measures. And there was really a dearth of evidence and reporting on these impacts.
The U.S. government identifies six parts to its counterterrorism policy, ranging from military actions to development projects. And I notice at the head of your report, you have a quote from Hillary Clinton where it would suggest that the U.S. government is sensitive to a gender approach. But what would it actually mean in practice to take a gender approach to counterterrorism policy?
Our objective in doing the report has been to both identify ways in which the U.S. government is inadvertently adversely impacting upon women's rights through these policies, but also to outline the ways in which the U.S. is thinking about gender. And in some instances, this increased attention to gender has been positive. But in other instances, for example, with the case in Afghanistan, attention to gender or rhetoric about women's rights has actually served to set back women's rights and to set women up as victims of terrorism. When we see that the U.S. government's rhetoric around women's rights is not matched in actuality by actions that would serve to further women's rights and women's movements on the ground, that there's actually an adverse impact in terms of women then being aligned with an occupying or an invading force.
Can we talk a little bit more about the example you give in Afghanistan? What is the U.S. doing that's being counterproductive, and what would you like to see them doing?
Well, presently, one of the main concerns is that the U.S. government has started negotiations with the Taliban with the eye to reintegrating some what are identified as like moderate Talibani into the government. And the main concern here from women and women's rights advocates is that in doing so, the U.S. is going to barter women's rights to achieve this short-term peace agreement.
And what about sexual minorities in countries like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan? How do U.S. policies marginalize the LGBT community?
One very prominent example has been the situation affecting LGBT individuals in Iraq, particularly since 2009. What we've seen is that U.S. policies have really failed to adequately protect women and sexual minorities from terrorism, and in fact that they've made things worse. So in Iraq, the situation has really been that Iraqi LGBTI individuals have been targets of insurgent and terrorist violence, and reports indicate also that they have also been brutally targeted by U.S.-trained Iraqi forces. And there has been a lot of criticism against the United States for this because the response to the attacks has been very mild. And there are also concerns that the U.S. government is not doing enough, for instance, through resettling more Iraqi LGBTI individuals to the United States to try to redress some of this harm that has been caused.
Lama Faki, co-author of A Decade Lost, Locating Gender in U.S. Counterterrorism from the Center for Human Rights and Global Justice at NYU School of Law. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
In Mexico, thousands of migrants passing through the country on their way to the U.S. are kidnapped each year. And in recent months, advocates have registered an increase in violence both against migrants and against advocates who provide them with basic services along their route. Shannon Young reports from Oaxaca City.
Passing through Mexico as an undocumented migrant has never been easy. The journey often involves exposure to the elements, hunger, confined conditions, and contact with corrupt officials. In recent years, kidnappings for ransom have been added to the list. At least 20,000 migrants are kidnapped in Mexico each year, according to data compiled by Mexico's Human Rights Commission. As organized crime groups have muscled into the business of controlling migrant routes in Mexico, pressure has also increased on those who provide basic services and protection.
Ya no hay distinción entre víctimas y defensores de derechos humanos.
Pedro Pantoja is a Catholic priest who runs a migrant shelter in the northern city of Saltillo. He says there's no longer a distinction between victims and human rights defenders, that both are subjected to the same attacks, and that the government does nothing as the attacks increase in frequency. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights issued protection orders for Father Pantoja and his team last year, but two international volunteers recently had to leave due to the deteriorating security situation at the shelter.
Organized criminals have come inside of our migrant shelter. There were no police patrol cars outside as a result of the protection orders. We see it not only as incompetence, but disdain. The authorities couldn't care less about the disaster, the social cruelty to which these people are subjected. They are completely invisible as victims. Even more invisible are those who victimize. And in all of this, there is not only silence, but also zero action, inefficacy, and a total lack of respect for the lives of these people.
Last month, a migrant shelter in the northern border city of Nuevo Laredo announced it had to close its doors due to threats and the lack of protection from authorities. The shelter served not only Central American migrants headed north, but also deported Mexican citizens who were often left at the border without the means to return to their homes in the interior. Nuevo Laredo is located in the state of Tamaulipas, where 72 migrants were massacred last year. The state, along with Veracruz and Tabasco, is a place where migrant kidnappings are common. The on-the-ground work of documenting these kidnappings falls precisely to the same shelter workers who provide basic services, people like Friar Tomás González from the southern city of Tenosique, Tabasco, near the border with Guatemala.
We don't just give food and water and first aid to migrants. We also document the human rights violations they suffer. Oftentimes, immigration authorities are identified as the culprits. So the alarms we raise alert the authorities and irritate some organized criminals. And it comes back to us, which is also something we have to document publicly. Not only have organized criminals intimidated some defenders of migrant human rights, but some authorities have also.
Accusations of government inaction or even complicity in crimes against migrants are nothing new. Shelter workers have been documenting them for years. But what has changed is the frequency with which the religious figures who run the shelters have been targeted. Alberto Herrera from the Mexican chapter of Amnesty International says it's part of a larger problem.
The central problem in the migration issue, from the viewpoint of Amnesty International, is the lack of efficiency, capability, and will to prosecute those responsible for these crimes. The rates of impunity are so high that they send a message to society in general that these types of crimes can continue to happen in Mexico with little risk that those responsible will be held accountable.
The issue of impunity isn't just limited to crimes against migrants. Data shows a prosecution rate of only 5% for all homicide victims in Mexico. Impunity also stretches to those who harm people, who document crimes, and defend victims. In the past 5 years, dozens of human rights defenders and journalists have been killed in Mexico, and history indicates that these crimes will also go unpunished. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
And now we turn to the Pacific Northwest, where a group of scientists is studying the health of the sea. As oceans absorb more and more carbon dioxide, their pH levels are dropping and oceans are becoming more acidic and corrosive. Biologists at the National Marine Fisheries Service in Seattle are examining how the marine world responds to this major side effect of fossil fuel emissions. FSRN's Martha Baskin recently joined scientists on a research vessel in Puget Sound.
Marine ecologists tug at drift nets full of fish from one of the world's most corrosive bodies of water, Puget Sound, in Washington State. Jellyfish and crab wait to be disentangled, and microscopic krill and zooplankton, undistinguishable to the untrained eye, but the base of the food web.
Well, we got quite the catch.
Corey Green and his team of fish biologists with the National Marine Fisheries Center.
Quite a few fish. A few jellyfish, too.
The task is to measure not only the abundance of marine life, the majority of species will be released, but levels of carbon dioxide. As oceans absorb more and more carbon dioxide, CO2, they become acidic and their pH levels drop. pH is the concentration of hydrogen ions, which results from dissolved CO2. Today's global average is 8.1, a 29% drop from pre-industrial times. but some waters in Puget Sound register 7.4.
These nearshore conditions are much less understood, but in a lot of ways they're more important because this is where a lot of the biological activity takes place.
Ecologist Paul McElhaney says nearshore environments and estuaries are critical to the food web.
They're the nurseries because it's where a lot of the larval fish are produced and rear before they head out further into the ocean to mature.
When baby shellfish failed to grow 5 years ago along the coasts of Washington and Oregon, scientists with National Marine Fisheries Service began looking at ocean acidification. Were acidic waters preventing shells from calcifying? They brought the larvae of shellfish and oysters into the lab and experimented with pH levels. Now they hope to measure pH levels in the waters where animals actually live. Again, Paul McElhaney.
There's been this snapshot look at CO2, but here we're trying to look at these realistic measurements of the pH so that we can know what the environment is that they're experiencing. We can then go back to the lab and relate our experiments to what the animals currently see and then project forward.
The study is the first of its kind in a coastal environment. It all begins with a pH probe, one calibrated to accurately measure conditions of seawater.
So with this measurement, we can get a different measure of pH. The probe that we have over the side that we're taking continuous measurements is at a fixed depth, and it's relatively shallow. So we're trying to correlate that with animals that are in the shallow depth.
Animals like krill and zooplankton, food for fish. There are many factors that affect abundance of species, including development and industry, pollution, food availability, temperature, and whether the water flushes or remains stagnant. This makes it a challenge to tease out the pH effect. Again, fish biologist Corey Green.
Because Puget Sound, you've got places that flush quite a bit, and then places where you got problems with the water just staying around.
Algae buildup is another factor, says Paul McElhaney. Too much of it depletes oxygen levels and compounds the problem of increased carbon dioxide.
So if there's not flushing, then you can get these, you know, kind of localized buildup of algae that then die off. As they die off, that can sort of increases the CO2 as they decompose.
And because waters in Puget Sound are fed by currents that well up from ocean depths, waters in this region are already more corrosive. Megalops, or the larval stage of Dungeness crab, is one critter that will be observed in the new study. Crabs are important ecologically and economically on the West Coast. In the lab, McElhaney looks at a crab the size of a thumbnail.
So we'll look at whether or not they can transition to the next larval stage. That's a stressful time physiologically for the animals, and it's when they need to generate calcium carbonate as part of putting on a new shell, which makes it challenging because we obviously can't test all the species in the ocean. There are a lot of them. We then have to kind of extrapolate and project how do we think the rest of them are going to do.
Initial results expected in a few weeks will show a map of pH patterns in the water where species being tested live. pH levels fluctuate widely, even from one area in a body of water to another, adding a new layer of complexity to understanding the full impact of fossil fuel emissions on Puget Sound's biologically critical waters. Martha Baskin, FSRN, Seattle.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor, Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Jane Chang. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.